is taken from St. Matthew's Gospel, chapter 27. We begin at verse 45. From the sixth hour until the ninth hour, darkness came over all the land. About the ninth hour, Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" When some of those standing there heard this, they said, "He's calling Elijah." Immediately, one of them ran and got a sponge. He filled it with wine vinegar, put it on a stick, and offered it to Jesus to drink. The rest said, "Now leave him alone. Let's see if Elijah comes to save him." And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit.
Jesus hangs nailed to a cross. And the first thing we read of here in the verses that Pam just read for us, the first thing we see is the darkness. 3 hours of darkness over all the land. An unnatural darkness. In the middle of the day, when it should be the brightest, there is darkness. And we know from the Bible that, from before in the Bible, that an unnatural darkness shows that God is angry. You see it in the plagues, don't you, in the Passover, in when Israel was rescued from Egypt. One of the plagues is darkness. God is angry. And if you could imagine being there as Jesus is crucified, you can look and peer through the darkness and see Jesus on the cross, and he is in agony. When it says he cried out in a loud voice, that is a very strong word that's used. It's a very powerful emotion that is being expressed there. Jesus is in gut-wrenching agony as he is on the cross. And he cries out near 3 o'clock, verse 46. It says, about the ninth hour, which is about 3 o'clock our time. Jesus cried out in a loud voice, "Eloi, Eloi, lama sabachthani," which means, my God, why have you forsaken me?" Now, you might expect that Jesus would shout out to his Father, my God, look what they've done to me." But he doesn't. He screams, my God, why have you forsaken me?" The judgment of God in the darkness is being focused on his Son. And it is an unbearable torment. Yes, the nails are agonizing, the cross is agonizing, but the thing that is really tormenting Jesus is that his Father has forsaken him. Here is Jesus bearing the awesome weight of sin. We need to see that his Father has forsaken him because our sin is laid upon him. And therefore, we need to see what Jesus is getting, what Jesus is going through, the agony that he is bearing is what our sin deserves. But because we're surrounded by sin, and it pervades our hearts, we don't see sin for how bad it is. But the cross shows us, doesn't it, what our sin deserves. If your and my sin is placed on Jesus and he is bearing God-forsakenness because of our sin, then this is what sin really deserves.
This God-forsakenness is what we deserve. Or maybe you think, well, God, maybe you're overdoing it a bit here. Sin is bad. Yes, okay, sin's bad, but it's not that bad, is it? But could we really look at Jesus on the cross and say, you know, you didn't really need to go this far. Sin doesn't deserve this. In which case, we would be saying to God, I think my scale of justice is better than yours, God. I think sin is not that bad. For which God would say, well, you would say that, you're covered in it. But God says sin deserves this. Do you think he would have put his son through more than was absolutely needed? Or maybe you say, well, yes, yeah, sin is bad, but my sin isn't that bad. I'm not as bad as other people. Yes, surely some others, maybe they need Jesus to die in agony for them, but my sin isn't that bad. Really? Only some of humanity needs Jesus to die for them, but not you. Again, do you really think God would have put his son through all this if some of humanity didn't need it? Sin deserves this punishment. Your sin deserves this punishment. My sin deserves this punishment. We deserve this. We deserve God-forsakenness. And so we need to see what Jesus went through is what we deserve. And this is what we will get without a Saviour. In times of revival, when revival has hit in other places, in other words, when people have turned to Jesus, in flocks of people have turned to Jesus, one of the things that you see, apparently, in those times is a great conviction of sin, a terror of what coming before God will be like, a burden, a sense of terror that when we come before God, we have our sin on us, and that drives people to Jesus. And that is a right conviction, isn't it? It seems an odd thing to pray, but we need to pray for those who aren't Christians in this area, in our families, that they might have a dreadful realization of their standing before God if they aren't yet believers. And as we look at Jesus on the cross, we need to realize this is what we deserve. Well, those standing by think he's calling Elijah, and so they give him a drink. Is it mocking him to give him the drink they give him, to give him the wine vinegar, or is it trying to help him? Well, commentators give different views on that. But they give him a drink, and then they say, leave him alone and see if Elijah will come to save him. And then after another agonized cry, maybe it's the cry of, it is finished. After another agonized cry, he dies. We're going to pause just for a couple of minutes. It's not on your orders of service, but we're just going to pause for a couple of minutes. In those few minutes, maybe you want to pray to God about your own sin. Sorry, actually, we're going to say the confession first, aren't we? And then we'll have a pause. So there's a confession on your sheet.
Continuing in Matthew chapter 27, from verse 50. And when Jesus had cried out again in a loud voice, he gave up his spirit. At that moment, the curtain of the temple was torn in two from top to bottom. The earth shook and the rocks split. The tombs broke open, and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs, and after Jesus' resurrection, they went into the holy city and appeared to many people. When the centurion and those with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, "Surely he was the Son of God."
So when Jesus dies, Matthew, as he writes this, takes us to various places, sort of almost all in one go. He takes us from the cross to the temple, to the tombs, which we find intriguing, we'll come on to in a moment, and then back to the cross. He does a sort of tour around, and we end up back at the cross again. So let's take them in turn. First off, we're at the cross, and Jesus dies. And what we find actually, if we go back to verse 45, is this is the moment at which the darkness ends. Because that's when Jesus cried out. He cried out at about the ninth hour, and that's when the darkness ends. So therefore, as Jesus dies, the darkness goes and the light comes back. God's anger has been spent. And then we fly across the city to the temple, where the curtain is torn in two from top to bottom. This is the curtain at the centre of the temple. And you know about this, I'm sure, if you've heard about this before. A wonderful moment that these two things going on at the same time. Jesus dies and the curtain of the temple torn in two from top to bottom. Why? What does the curtain represent? The curtain represents a big no entry sign, doesn't it? The temple itself represented God's presence amongst his people. I mean, they knew that God is bigger than a temple, of course, but it represented God's presence with his people. And there were concentric circles, as it were, going to the middle of the temple, and various people could get so far. You know, everyone could be outside the temple, but only some people could go in a certain distance, and then only fewer could go in even further. And then sort of towards the middle, you could only get the priests going in there. And then even further, there was right in the middle, there was the Holy of Holies, which represented God's presence. But basically, no one could go in there. I mean, you couldn't just stroll in. No, only one person was allowed in there, and only once a year. Well, that's basically saying you can't come in, isn't it? And so, for the curtain of the temple to be torn in two from top to bottom, showing that it was God ripping it in two, is for God to say, you can come in. There is no impediment now to you coming into my presence. Because my son has died, now you can come in. You can come in. You don't need a curtain there anymore. You don't need anything to stop you. And therefore, actually, what's happening here is God is actually also saying you don't need the temple anymore. Because the temple was there saying the only way to get into God's presence, well, because in front of the Holy of Holies and before you got in there, there was an altar. You had, if anyone was going to get into God's presence, and that was only going to be one person once a year, they had to kill something. There had to be bloodshed. There had to be animals sacrificed. But now God is saying the sacrifice has taken place outside Jerusalem at the cross. So now you don't need the temple anymore. The temple is redundant. You can just come into God's presence because the sacrifice has taken place. See, while our sin deserves the cross because Jesus took the cross, the way is now made open to God, with sins washed away. And so we go now from the temple and we fly over to the tombs. Now, this is the bit you're probably wondering about. No other gospel includes this detail. What's going on here? Because it says, verse 52, the tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. Now, this seems like an incredible detail for other gospels not to include. What's going on here? Well, we've got no reason to think it didn't happen. I mean, it's a bit like a firework display where you've got one big firework going off and then you've got a whole load of little fireworks going off around the outside. I mean, the main thing is the big firework. If you were to write about it, you'd talk about the big firework. But here, Matthew also includes, oh, by the way, there were little fireworks going on around the edge, which is the resurrection of other people. Now, if you're not a Christian and you're questioning, did the resurrection really happen? This probably isn't the place to start. There isn't a huge amount of evidence, as it were, for the resurrection of these other people when Jesus died, but go for the resurrection of Jesus, because there's huge amounts of evidence for that. But the timing looks a little bit odd, if you were following it. So again, verse 52... It says, the tombs broke open and the bodies of many holy people who had died were raised to life. They came out of the tombs and after Jesus' resurrection went into the holy city and appeared to many people. Well, that looks like, so Jesus dies, tombs burst open, these dead are raised, but they hang around the tombs for a while. And then after Jesus is raised, then they decide to go into Jerusalem and then they're seen by lots of people. That seems like a slightly odd timing. I mean, maybe it happened that way. A suggestion has been, or someone has argued fairly strongly, that actually you should change where the full stop is. In other words, that you have the full stop after the tombs broke open. So what happens is, Jesus dies, there's an earthquake, tombs break open, but the bodies of the many holy people who had died don't raise to life until Jesus raises to life. Okay, so all that that's suggesting is that the resurrection of these other people happens when Jesus rises, and then they go into their holy city and are seen by lots of people. Okay, fair enough. That could be the way around it is. But if that's the case, Matthew has deliberately inserted it here. Why? Why has he put it here if it actually happens a bit later on? And I think what Matthew is trying to say is, look, the death of Jesus brings life. It is because Jesus died that you can have life, that the resurrection is possible. It's almost as if Matthew is saying, look, when Jesus died, it's like life just couldn't hold back raising people from the dead. It's like life just had to spring out. Like you might see at springtime where you see flowers just bursting forth and they kind of come up in your garden, in your lawn, or in, you know, in wonderful places where you just see there's just life just comes up and leaves suddenly coming back on trees and there's kind of just life everywhere. It's almost as if with Jesus' death, life just couldn't help itself but from bursting forth. And even saints who'd been dead for a long time suddenly are back to life and are walking around the city. Wonderful, but true. And it's a pointer forward, isn't it, for us to say, actually, the death and resurrection of Jesus means we will one day rise to life. We will have physical bodies, resurrection bodies. We won't be wisps. But we're looking forward to being resurrected bodies, to seeing one another, meeting one another, socializing together, talking to one another, and being with Jesus. And that is what we're looking forward to. The death of Jesus means we will have life forever. And it's like life was just bursting out at the death of Jesus. Well, we go from the tombs back to the cross. And you've got the centurion and others, verse 54, says, when the centurion and those who were with him who were guarding Jesus saw the earthquake and all that had happened, they were terrified and exclaimed, surely he was the Son of God. How much did they really grasp? We don't really know. Was it real faith? Don't know. Maybe. But this centurion has seen and heard people mocking Jesus. Just verse 43, just back over the page, he's heard people say of Jesus, he trusts in God. Let God rescue him now if he wants to, for he said, I am the Son of God. And now the centurion sees Jesus die, sees the darkness, feels the earthquake and goes, well, surely this man really was the Son of God. And we need to bow before him as that centurion did. Bow before him whose death opens the temple and opens the grave whose death makes a way into God's presence and defeats death. We need to bow before him too. Well, again, we're going to have a couple of minutes pause before we sing our next song.
Continuing in Matthew 27 from verse 55, many women were there watching from a distance. They had followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. As evening approached, there came a rich man from Arimathea, named Joseph, who had himself become a disciple of Jesus. Going to Pilate, he asked for Jesus' body, and Pilate ordered that it be given to him. Joseph took the body, wrapped it in a clean linen cloth, and placed it in his own new tomb that he had cut out of the rock. He rolled a big stone in front of the entrance to the tomb and went away. Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb.
Well, in the next couple of sections, this section and the next section that we'll read, we see that various objections to the resurrection are actually taken away from us. There are two emphases in this first section, and the two emphases in this section that Pam just read for us are that Jesus was dead and he was buried, and both are very significant, aren't they? He was dead. The women witnessed his death. So we see that in verse 55 and 56. Many women were there watching from a distance. They'd followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons. These women particularly named, and we'll see why in just a few moments. But they see Jesus die. We know from the other Gospels, Pilate made sure Jesus was dead. The soldiers made sure Jesus was dead. They shoved a spear in his side to make sure. Joseph asks for the body and wraps it in a clean linen cloth, we are told. Jesus was dead. He hadn't swooned, as Muslims say he had. There is no evidence of that. He was definitely dead. Wrapped up, placed in a tomb, and the stone rolled in front. So he was dead and he was buried. And two of the same women witnessed the burial. Verse 61, we're told Mary Magdalene and the other Mary were sitting there opposite the tomb. So Matthew is telling us these women, they were there when Jesus died. They were sitting opposite the tomb as Jesus was buried. And what you see at the beginning of chapter 28 is it's the same women who see the resurrection. Why is that significant? Matthew is telling us these same names three times in the space of just a few verses. Well, experts tell us this is because Matthew is teaching us, he's telling us history. He's trying to record history for us. This is how they did it. They would write down the names of people who saw it so that you could check with those eyewitnesses. This is Matthew giving you history, giving you evidence. They saw Jesus buried. And it's helpful that these are women who saw these things, because back then, women didn't have a voice. Their testimony wouldn't be accepted in court. Now, that's helpful for us because if someone was making this up, you wouldn't include the women as the first people witnessing the resurrection. We may think, well, that's just sexist of them. But actually, this is great. This is even more evidence for us that the resurrection really happened. And Joseph asks for the body. This was a brave thing for him to do, to be associated with someone who'd been executed. And it's unusual that it was agreed to that the body would be put in a tomb, because this is someone who's been executed. Again, the commentaries suggest, well, this seems like it's Pilate, knowing that Jesus was innocent, agrees to him being put in a tomb. But normally, if someone was executed, their body would just be left to rot on the cross, or when they finished rotting, they would just be thrown in a mass grave. There was no, nothing nice done for the body. But Pilate agrees to Joseph taking Jesus's body and putting it in a new tomb. And again, this is even more helpful for us for the resurrection. You see, if Jesus had just been thrown in a mass grave, and then people said, oh, look, Jesus has risen to life again, well, people could have said, well, maybe you got the wrong body. Maybe it was dragged off by wild animals. Maybe you looked in the wrong place. But no, this is a particular tomb. It was Joseph's tomb, and it was a new tomb, meaning there were no other bodies in that tomb. There was only one body in there. The women were watching the tomb. They knew where it was placed. And a big stone rolled in front of the tomb. He was dead and he was buried. Very important things for us when it comes to Sunday. We're not there yet, but they're very significant things. Now, we're going to pause again just for a few moments. And can I encourage you in this time to pray? Pray for those who don't yet believe in the resurrection of Jesus. Pray for people who aren't yet Christians. Pray also for those you know who are suffering in any way, who are struggling, that the Lord would use their struggles and their difficulties to bring them to Jesus, or if they're already Christians, to trust in Jesus all the more. Let's spend a few moments together praying silently for those people. And then after that pause, we'll have the next reading.
The final section of this chapter is from verse 62. The next day, the one after preparation day, the chief priests and the Pharisees went to Pilate. "Sir," they said, "we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.' So give the order for the tomb to be made secure until the third day. Otherwise, his disciples may come and steal the body and tell the people that he has been raised from the dead. This last deception will be worse than the first." "Take a guard," Pilate answered. "Go, make the tomb as secure as you know how." So they went and made the tomb secure by putting a seal on the stone and posting the guard.
Well, the religious leaders want to make sure there's going to be no rumor of a resurrection. And therefore, the actions that they take, which are designed to squash any possibility of a story of Jesus rising from the dead, actually only go to make the evidence even greater for the fact that he has risen from the dead on the Sunday. So they go to Pilate and they ask, verse 63, "Sir, we remember that while he was still alive, that deceiver said, 'After 3 days I will rise again.'" Interestingly, they seem to remember this better than the disciples do. Oh, they don't believe it. Don't think that. They don't believe that he's going to rise from the dead, but they remember that he'd said he would. Probably, actually, they were told by Judas that that's what Jesus had said. And so, fearing that the disciples will come and steal the body, they ask for a guard to be placed at the tomb. And Pilate says, make the tomb as secure as you know how. Do whatever you need to do. Do it as well as you can do it. Make it secure. That body is going to stay in that tomb. And it's important to know this because of what happens after the resurrection. We're told later on in chapter 28 that the guard are then paid lots of money to say that the disciples did steal the body while they were asleep. I mean, they could have got into a lot of trouble for that, but they were assured they wouldn't get into trouble. And so the rumor was obviously going round, and Matthew therefore wants to record this to say, this is why the rumor is going round that the body was stolen. It's because the guards were paid to say it. But nothing was going to cover up the truth. Because Jesus did rise. Oh, but we're not there yet, are we? We're still in chapter 27. So at the end of chapter 27, Jesus is dead and buried, and a guard is placed on the tomb, and the stone is sealed, and no one is going to get in and steal this body. In many ways, at the end of chapter 27, it seems hopeless, doesn't it? But Sunday's coming.
It's Friday. Jesus is praying. Peter's asleep. Judas is betraying. But Sunday's coming. It's Friday. Pilate's struggling. The council is conspiring. The crowd is vilifying. They don't even know that Sunday's coming. It's Friday. The disciples are running like sheep without a shepherd. Mary's crying. Peter is denying. But they don't know that Sunday's a coming. It's Friday. The Romans beat my Jesus. They robe him in scarlet. They crown him with thorns. But they don't know that Sunday's coming. It's Friday. See Jesus walking to Calvary. His blood dripping. His body stumbling. And his spirit's burdened. But you see, it's only Friday. Sunday's coming. It's Friday. The world's winning. People are sinning, and evil's grinning. It's Friday. The soldiers nailed my Savior's hands to the cross. They nailed my Savior's feet to the cross. And then they raised him up next to criminals. It's Friday. But let me tell you something. Sunday's coming. It's Friday. The disciples are questioning what has happened to their king. And the Pharisees are celebrating that their scheming has been achieved. But they don't know. It's only Friday. Sunday's coming. It's Friday. He's hanging on the cross, feeling forsaken by his Father. Left alone and dying. Can nobody save him? Oh, it's Friday. But Sunday's coming. It's Friday. The earth trembles. The sky grows dark. My king yields his spirit. It's Friday. Hope is lost. Death has won. Sin has conquered, and Satan's just a laughing. It's Friday. Jesus is buried. A soldier stands guard, and a rock is rolled into place. But it's Friday. It is only Friday. Sunday is a coming.